has gotten some number of women, dozens, who knows, to sign non-disclosure agreements, both for sexual harassment and for gender discrimination in the workplace. So, Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements so we can hear their side of the story?
We have a very few non-disclosure agreements.
How many is that?
Let me finish.
How many is that?
None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like a joke I told.
Elizabeth Warren laying into former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg at last night's debate. Bloomberg's company has been the target of multiple lawsuits over the years with claims ranging from sex discrimination to rape. Well, in this Me Too climate, people want to know what's hiding in those lawsuits and NDAs. But Bloomberg said last night he won't release anyone from the NDAs he signed.
Son of the company and somebody else, in this case, a man or a woman, or could be more than that, they decided when they made an agreement that they wanted to keep it quiet for everybody's interest. They signed the agreements, and that's what we're going to live with.
I'm sorry.
Well, joining us to talk about all this is Anna North, senior reporter at Vox. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with this question Elizabeth Warren brought up last night. Is there any way to know just how many NDAs are out there?
We currently don't know that. We do know that Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg himself have faced a number of lawsuits over the years. Business Insider did some reporting on this in November, found the company had faced nearly 40 lawsuits, and the majority of those were about discrimination of some kind. So there's a lot out there, but there's also a lot we don't know, including exactly how many people have had to sign NDAs.
And who they were between. He seemed to say that he wasn't a party to them, that they were his employees. Is he involved in any of these lawsuits?
He is personally named in a number of lawsuits, and he is personally the target of allegations in some lawsuits. Now, not of committing sexual assault, but he is named as having made some very serious sexist comments, some discriminatory comments. Those are things that that plaintiffs have attributed directly to him in lawsuits going back decades.
And what are some of the details?
So probably some of the most striking suits, there's one, the Washington Post highlighted a couple of these over the weekend that really brought a lot more attention to the issue. One woman says that when she told Bloomberg that she was pregnant, that he said, kill it. And she, you know, said, what did you say? And he said, kill it again. And then he made a comment like, great, number 16, a reference to 16 people at the company who maybe were either pregnant or on maternity leave. And the same person in her lawsuit also detailed a number of other sexist comments that she said that he made over the time that she was employed by him, and racist comments in addition. There's another lawsuit, this one also from the 1990s, that says that Bloomberg himself made comments about female employees like, quote, I'd like to do that piece of meat. Now, Bloomberg has denied all of this, but certainly there would be more information if presumably if people were released from their NDAs.
Right. And this all allegedly happened in the 90s or more recently, too?
There are more recent allegations as well. So one of the most recent suits that Business Insider found was in 2016. The suit was filed in 2016. A woman said that she had been sexually assaulted by a senior employee or a more senior employee to her at Bloomberg. And she accused Bloomberg of creating a sexist environment where something like this could happen.
And so he has been asked about this, about whether this environment comes from him personally. What has been his response typically?
You know, his response has been to say that he did tell some jokes over the years that he regrets. You know, there's another thing that came out in the Washington Post was a sort of a book of quotes that were attributed to Bloomberg. A number of, you know, I think to a lot of people, fairly offensive comments in there. Jokes about, you know, female employees performing oral sex and things of that nature that could be considered very offensive. He has said he didn't say those things, but he has said, you know, I made some jokes and I regret them, and you know, I don't do that anymore. In terms of larger allegations of discrimination, he has pushed back and his campaign has pushed back on those aggressively, saying he never discriminated against anyone and that his company and his campaigns have always been good places for women to work. You know, so he is pushing back against this vigorously. At the same time, you know, his comment that, you know, something was about a joke someone didn't like. I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to land with a lot of voters in 2020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He did point that out last night, that he has promoted many women to positions of power. His deputy mayor, when he was mayor of New York City, was a woman. And then I think just last year, his company increased paid family leave from 18 to 26 weeks. All of that, does that mitigate the comments that he has made?
You know, I mean, I will say that their family leave policy is more generous than that of a lot of companies. And, you know, this country, there is often people have no paid leave whatsoever. So certainly that's a step by his company in the right direction. You know, but I think Senator Warren alluded to this, and others have alluded to this too, that, you know, if you treat some female employees well, or you elevate some to positions of power, that doesn't necessarily mean that everyone was treated well. And it doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't a climate of discrimination for others at a company.
Do you think he'll eventually bow to pressure to release the women from the NDAs?
It's a really interesting question. This has just become a bigger and bigger issue as the Me Too movement has risen to greater prominence. There have been a lot of calls from a lot of companies to release people from NDAs. NBC has faced calls like this, and it did end up saying that employees could be released from their NDAs if they went to NBC and asked to be released. So that was a step, but a lot of people said, well, if I have to contact, you know, if I have to contact HR and say, please release me, that's, you know, a difficult position if someone has been in a very hostile relationship with a company or feels discriminated against. But so there is that precedent of some people being released from them. Whether Bloomberg will want to do it as an active presidential candidate is another question. I'm not sure what we'll see from him.
Hmm. And more broadly, what do you think this is going to mean for his support amongst Democrats, and in particular Democratic women? You know, we saw back in the 90s with President Clinton, a lot of women supported him in the Monica Lewinsky situation, and yet condemning President Trump for his actions regarding women. Do you think that things have shifted for Democratic women, that they would absolutely not support someone like Mike Bloomberg if it comes out that he had, you know, in these NDAs, had covered up some serious egregious behavior?
You know, it's a complicated question. I think one thing that's going to be difficult for Bloomberg is that he is really running as an alternative to Trump. You know, a lot of his ads so far have been targeted at Trump. They haven't necessarily even been targeted at other Democrats in the primary. In one ad, you know, he talks about Trump bullying and lying, and he highlights that comment, you know, that a lot of feminists were especially disturbed by when Trump called Hillary Clinton such a nasty woman. So Bloomberg is really trying to position himself as someone who's very different from Trump. Now, the allegations against Bloomberg are different from the allegations against Trump. But, you know, if Bloomberg is trying to say he's better for instance, for female voters, for women in America than Trump, and he has these allegations of sexism that have already come to light, that just makes it a tougher argument. And I'll also say, too, that we've seen in polling recently that it's not just female voters who care about these issues, but it's also men, especially Democratic and independent men, you know, who are concerned about, you know, sort of the power that men hold in American government and the way that they sometimes misuse it. So I think for really voters of all genders, these comments could continue to be an issue for Bloomberg.
Anna North is a senior reporter at Vox. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
More now on last night's debate, and a moment when Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders responded to a question about some of his supporters who can be vicious online.
We have over 10.6 million people on Twitter, and 99.9% of them are decent human beings, are working people, are people who believe in justice, compassion, and love. And if there are a few people who make ugly remarks, who attack trade union leaders, I disown those people. They are not part of our movement.
But Pete Buttigieg pushed back.
Senator, when you say that you disown these attacks and you didn't personally direct them, I believe you.
Well, thank
but
you.
But at a certain point, you got to ask yourself, why did this pattern arise? Why is it especially the case among your supporters?
I don't think it is especially the case, by the way.
That's just not true.
So is it especially the case? What is up with the Bernie bro phenomenon? We're going to talk about that now with Matt Flegenheimer. He recently wrote about this for The New York Times. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, so let's just try to answer that question. Is it especially the case that Sanders has particularly animated and negative supporters online who go after people viciously?
I think there's a couple things at play here. Obviously, anecdotally, those who are not supporters of Senator Sanders have said that no other campaign attracts the sort of vitriol, if you criticize a candidate online, as his. There is also this factor of a lot of Sanders supporters being younger and probably overrepresented online. There is certainly a demographic issue here as well. Joe Biden does not have the same level of enthusiasm among young supporters, and there's not sort of an equivalent online base. But with all of that said, I do think that across 2016 and 2020, there is a sense among rival campaigns that there's something else at play here with Bernie Sanders, and that there is a level of venom in excess of other campaigns.
Mm-hmm. And could he be doing more to try to tamp that down?
It's tricky. Obviously, he would say that he is disowning this, he is disavowing it, he is saying we don't want this as part of the movement. Certainly you heard what Mayor Buttigieg said last night, referencing this idea that a candidate is responsible for the culture that is being cultivated in his or her name. I think you've heard Senator Warren say that as well. So yeah, I do think there is certainly a level of awareness within the campaign. There has been since 2016, 2015 even, that this is a political headache and that harassment being undertaken in the name of someone who's trying to lead a Democratic Party is not a good look in a Democratic primary.
Mm. And so you relay an anecdote between Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Sanders where she basically asks him, do we have a problem here? Can you talk about that?
Sure. So this was in the summer of 2017, before the presidential campaign. There was certainly an expectation that both of them might be running in 2020. And indeed, that did come to pass. So this was as some supporters of Sanders's who had grown aware of the fact that Senator Harris was likely to run, there was a level of criticism that started to pick up in that summer, both online and in news articles. And as it reached a sort of critical mass, Senator Harris came up to him on the Senate floor and said, do we have a problem? And the response that she got was, there's no problem, and I can't control what my followers say, how they communicate effectively, was what Senator Sanders conveyed to her.
Mm-hmm.
So there is certainly, and you heard that more or less last night on the debate stage, there is certainly a sense in the Sanders campaign that he is held to a different standard, that he is asked to answer for the worst behavior of his supporters in a way that others aren't.
Right. And are there equivalents in other campaigns? Is there a small minority, maybe smaller, because as you say, fewer are online, but is there a vocal minority in other campaigns who are doing the same thing?
Sure. I mean, it's all the volume is sort of anecdotally seen as greater in the Sanders camp, but there is no question, and he referenced this last night on stage again, that there are members of his campaign, women, people of color often, who are subjected to much vitriol online and who receive very menacing messages. The internet's a pretty terrible place sometimes, mm-hmm. and that is sort of universally true across the field. With that said, there is something different about the Bernie Sanders campaign and the level of zeal and often venom coming from the supporters of his.
So this all began in 2016 with this Bernie bro phenomenon, when it was called a Bernie bro phenomenon. How did it begin?
It began, I guess, sort of organically. This was as the enthusiasm for his campaign grew, you had these complaints start to arise that anytime there was criticism of him in any forum, there was just a sort of disproportionate response, a kind of deluge that would come their way. The shorthand of Bernie bro sort of owed to this trope that it was often male, often white male supporters of his who were the most aggressive. The campaign is particularly sensitive to that moniker now as he is trying to sort of build out a very diverse coalition. He has probably the most Hispanic support in this race, certainly support among every demographic in one way or another across the board. So I think they're almost more sensitive at times to the bro part of the Bernie bro than anything. And that has certainly been a trope they've tried to tamp down in 2020.
Hmm. So I'm wondering if the female candidates in the race are particular targets versus the other candidates.
It's hard to say. Certainly, I mean, the anecdote obviously with Kamala Harris comes to mind. But I do think, certainly in the case of Elizabeth Warren, we've seen coming out of the sort of feud that the two of them had in January around whether Senator Sanders said to her in 2018 that a woman couldn't win the presidency in this private conversation that was reported initially by CNN. And in the aftermath of that, when she sort of challenged him on the debate stage about his version of events, you saw this sort of emoji campaign on Twitter and elsewhere where Sanders supporters were tweeting snakes at Warren, at her supporters. And it's sort of the volume and the kind of flood-like quality to the feedback that his critics get that really is what's striking to a lot of those who have been on the other side of it.
Let's play another clip from last night's debate where he tried to explain some of this online vitriol.
Now, let me say something else about this, not being too paranoid. All of us remember 2016. And what we meant, what we remember is efforts by Russians and others to try to interfere in our election and divide us up. I'm not saying that's happening, but it would not shock me.
Okay, so he's saying that it could be Russian trolls, bots, whatever, fueling this. Any truth to that?
I mean, as you look to 2016, there are certainly coordinated efforts by Russian actors to interfere in the election, with an emphasis on two candidates, obviously Donald Trump being one and Bernie Sanders being the other. There was this idea that boosting them while sort of denigrating their opponents would serve Russian interests. So there is certainly every reason to believe that the trolls and bots are a part of this stew in some fashion. The percentages are hard to figure. There are certainly many, many flesh and blood Bernie supporters who are counted among those who are harassing others online, according to Sanders critics.
Hmm. So how would this translate into the general election? If Sanders does not get the nomination, what will his supporters do? Would they support the nominee or stay home?
Obviously, it's case by case, but even a small level of defection can make a big difference. There is certainly fear among Democrats, particularly in the sort of establishment wing, that any nominee other than Bernie Sanders will be deemed unacceptable to some non-trivial portion of Sanders supporters. Although, frankly, at this point, there is also the question of whether those who oppose Bernie Sanders would be willing to support him in a general election. He is the one who has won New Hampshire. He's the one who's looking strongest going into the upcoming states in a lot of ways. So that question sort of cuts both ways.
And maybe the vitriol online could sway some people not to support him.
Sure. I mean, there's certainly, in conversations with voters, I have certainly heard that for all of their potential identification with the politics of Bernie Sanders and affection for the issues he's brought attention to, there is something unbecoming in their mind about the support base and associating with some of the behavior. And I do think that's been a deterrent in at least a few cases in conversations I've had with voters.
Well, Matt, thanks.
Thanks so much.
Matt Flagenheimer from The New York Times. Coming up, what the judge said to Roger Stone before she sentenced him to more than 3 years in prison and what the chances are of a presidential pardon. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. 3 years and 4 months. That's the prison sentence President Trump's longtime friend and political advisor Roger Stone received today. A jury convicted Stone of lying to Congress and witness tampering. His sentence comes as the Justice Department navigates internal turmoil and a mounting credibility crisis. Well, before the sentence was handed down, Trump tweeted that Stone has been treated unfairly and that his political rivals should be the ones on trial. And after it was handed down, he said he was, quote, following this very closely and that Stone has a very good chance of exoneration. Joining me to talk about this is Darren Samuelson. He covered the trial for Politico. Hi.
Good afternoon.
All right. So 40 months, that's about what, half of what prosecutors originally recommended. Is that more or less than what people had expected?
I think it's about in line with what people expected. 7 to 9 years was probably always seen as a large sentence. That is what the initial trial team had proposed in the initial sentencing recommendations that later Bill Barr and the Justice Department overruled and, you know, watered down, so to speak. Judge Jackson today during the sentencing indicated that she was never planning to go the full 7 to 9 year route. So 3 years is, I think it's just enough to obviously put a, you know, put a damper on Roger Stone's plans for some period of time. It's going to make it a little bit more challenging for President Trump, who I think will ultimately pardon his longtime ally and associate, but it's not, you know, the 10, 14, 15 year period. I mean, he could have gotten 50 was the maximum that he was facing here today. And Judge Jackson, you know, certainly threw all of the charges at him here today during the course of the sentencing and made it clear that he had done quite a few things that she thought were wrong.
Yeah, I just want to repeat a couple of things she said. She said, this is intolerable to the administration of justice. The court should not sit idly by, shrug its shoulders, and say, that's just Roger being Roger. What was she referring to?
Yeah, you know, throughout the course of the pretrial process, Roger Stone had been through social media, him and his allies and his family had been firing off all manner of tweets and other posts that were questioning his own indictment. There was at one point where he actually posted something on Instagram that seemed to threaten Judge Jackson with a crosshairs over her head. And she saw that as intimidating, you know, the most important juror in the course of the trial. So there was genuine security concerns throughout the whole process leading up to last November's trial. There was concerns, you know, as people are coming and going from the courthouse, that Judge Jackson was worried that not just Roger Stone, not Roger Stone himself, but his supporters, someone could, you know, do something that certainly, you know, raised a level of threat at the building. And that is part of the administration of the justice process. The jurors themselves, she was looking out for and worried about. And there was an attempt, you know, constantly to try and identify the jurors during the actual pretrial process. And you know, that was one of the many parts. I mean, obviously, Roger Stone was convicted of obstruction of justice and witness tampering with respect to the Russia investigation. And she also threw some additional, I think, not say charges, but, you know, she upped the sentence in part because of the social media campaign, and there was, you know, a gag order that was on him that was supposed to limit his ability to do some of that stuff, and that was in part from the criticisms that he was mounting about the case during the pretrial process.
Yeah. So she said, at his core, Mr. Stone is an insecure person who craves and recklessly pursues attention. Nothing about this case was a joke. It wasn't funny. What was his reaction in the courtroom to the sentence and to her words?
Well, he was standing for about 45 minutes while she read through her opinion, her reasoning for why she was reaching the sentence that she was. And for most of the time, Roger Stone was just standing there with his hands clasped in front of him or his hands in his pockets. He did have a small grin on his face a couple of times as I was watching. I was watching through a closed-circuit TV monitor that was available for the reporters who were able to actually get a chance to see Roger Stone's face rather than if you're sitting in the courtroom, you're looking at his back. He was surrounded by three of his lawyers that he had brought with him. He had a large legal defense team. After the sentencing was ultimately read, he declined to comment as he left the courthouse. He is now trying to get a second trial, a retrial in this case. And so, you know, in the course of where he stands right now, obviously he's probably wanting to not necessarily be saying anything publicly. You know, Judge Jackson will be ruling on that here in the coming days on whether or not a second trial will even happen.
What is that based on? It's based on a juror making some comments after the verdict was handed down?
Yeah, well, we haven't actually seen the documents that the Stone team has filed. I believe they're under seal right now, but I think we have seen that it appears to be that he is claiming that the foreperson of the juror of that original jury was a Democratic member of ran for Congress as a Democrat, and also had put up some social media posts critical of the president and was tweeting during the trial as well, not about the trial. But she was definitely tweeting politically. Now, you know, jurors are allowed to have, you know, First Amendment views. They're supposed to obviously set them aside during the course of a trial and you know, just render their opinion based on the facts presented during the case, and they take an oath to do that. Roger Stone's lawyers did know that she was a person who had ran for Congress, and they had a chance, and even asked her, I think, one or two questions about this during the voir dire process before they picked the jury, and they could have struck her if they felt like that she was someone that they didn't want on the jury. They chose not to. They chose not to press for any additional, you know, more than, I think, two or three questions for this particular woman. And so that's the question that Judge Jackson will now need to deal with, whether that itself is something that would lead to a new trial. It's hard to say that she will. Certainly by sentencing Roger Stone today, she clearly was dealing with the first trial. She did also say that she wasn't ordering Roger Stone taken into custody immediately today after she sentenced him. That will wait until Judge Amy Berman Jackson deals with this motion for a new trial.
Well, even if he doesn't get a new trial, he might get a presidential pardon. His spokeswoman, this woman named Kristen Davis, just issued a statement saying it's odd to pronounce a sentence before ascertaining the integrity of the trial. And she references this juror misconduct allegation. And then at the end of it, she says it falls on President Trump to use the power of a pardon as the final means of checks and balances to right this horrible wrong. What is the likelihood of a presidential pardon now?
I think it's really high. Before we had the sentence today, I think I have a story that published this morning in Politico, quoting a former senior administration official saying it's not if, but when. And, I mean, it could come today. It probably won't, in the fact that Roger Stone is actually not going to jail today, so they don't need to do it right now. But I think once we get to a point where Roger Stone is actually, you know, required to go to jail and be booked into a federal prison, I think that's when we would see the pardon. It could come before the election. It just depends on when the rubber hits the road and when Roger Stone is ordered to report to prison. Donald Trump and Roger Stone go back four decades. They have a long friendship. Roger Stone was there for three of President Trump's previous flirtations with running for president. He was in touch with Donald Trump throughout the 2016 campaign. You know, you heard from President Trump just in the last 30 or so minutes, a clear indication that he expects Roger Stone to be exonerated. And that very well might mean that Roger Stone's record is going to be wiped clean once this is all said and done. You know, the president has the power to pardon and certainly feels emboldened after, you know, the impeachment trial now is in the rearview mirror. And I think seeing the pardons and the commutations that were granted earlier this week from everyone from the San Francisco 49ers former owner to Governor Blagojevich, I think the chances are very high that ultimately Roger Stone also gets some form of clemency. Whether it's a commutation of his sentence or a straight-up pardon, I think is to be determined.
Darren Samuelson is senior reporter for Politico. Darren, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the extraordinary lengths one man went to smuggle falcon eggs across the world.
Carrying 14 odd colored eggs taped to his body with hospital gauze, each one encased in a wool sock.
The Falcon Thief, next on Press Play. You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Now, a true crime story. It's 2010. A janitor at a British airport notices something fishy about a passenger in the Emirates Airlines first class lounge. The passenger had entered the lounge's shower room carrying a shoulder bag and two small suitcases. He was in there for 25 minutes. That's a pretty long time to spend in a bathroom at the airport. So the janitor, who had recently taken a terrorism workshop, decided to inspect. The passenger had not touched the shower, didn't appear to have used the toilet. The sink didn't have a single drop of water in it. And at the bottom of an otherwise empty trash can, there was a box. Well, that sounds like the beginning of an American gangster or traffic-like drug smuggling story. But it's actually the beginning of a true story of an epic smuggler of birds. Yes, birds and their eggs. Joshua Hammer is the author of The Falcon Thief, a true tale of adventure, treachery, and the hunt for the perfect bird. And he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, what was in that box in the trash can?
In the box, which was a green cardboard egg carton, was a single red egg. He's quickly grabbed by the counterterrorism forces at the airport, who take him to an interrogation lounge, strip him down, find him carrying 14 odd colored eggs taped to his body with hospital gauze, each one encased in a wool sock. They ask him, what's going on? What are you doing? What is this? He says, they're duck eggs. They ask him, why are you carrying raw duck eggs strapped to your body, hidden under your clothing? And he says his chiropractor had recommended that he wear raw eggs attached to his belly so he would be forced to keep his muscles taut and strengthen his lower back.
So an obvious lie to
so
the investigators.
Yeah, I mean, the counterterrorism police had never heard. They just didn't know what to do with this fellow, with what he was carrying, with the stories he was telling. None of it made any sense. So at that point, they summon the hero of the story, Andy McWilliam, a veteran wildlife cop who has, over the course of a decade working on wildlife-related crimes, become one of Britain's foremost experts in bird-related transgressions, shall we say. And there are a whole variety of them.
Right. And so we'll get to that, why there seem to be so many of these. But what is Andy McWilliam? What does he immediately think? What does he suspect?
So McWilliam sizes this guy up from afar. He hears that this guy was apparently was wearing them strapped to his body, which McWilliam believed this was not an attempt to conceal them, but rather to keep them warm, because he suspected they were alive. And the big clue is that the passenger was on his way to Dubai. So he put everything together and surmised that this person, or who the counterterrorism police had arrested, was taking live wild peregrine falcon eggs that he had snatched somewhere from an aerie somewhere in the United Kingdom and was taking them to Dubai to deliver to wealthy Arab falconers.
Wow. Why is there such a market for peregrine falcons in Dubai?
So the Arabs are absolutely falconry obsessed. They've been doing this for 3,000 years. The sport has really become the provenance of the wealthiest Arabs, because there isn't that much room to hunt anymore in the United Arab Emirates. The prey that the birds like has been pretty much eradicated, and the desert has shrunk. So this is relegated to a small select group of elite sheikhs, who greatly admire, as they have for centuries, the peregrine falcon, which can hunt from heights of 5,000 feet, drop down at speeds of up to 180 miles an hour, and snatch their prey, usually birds, out of the air with their talons, kill them on the spot. There's a sort of magnificent cruelty and beauty to these birds that greatly appeals to the sensibility of these fellows. And on top of that, the joy that they get out of hunting with these birds, they're also very avid. In the last 20 years, they've become avid racers. They've trained many of these birds to race across courses, to race horizontally rather than plunge vertically. And they bet on the races. And so there's just – they are falcon obsessed in many different ways. You have both the hunters and the racers. And they're eager to get their hands on wild birds, which are highly protected, because of a belief that natural selection has created the fastest – most beautiful, strongest, smartest birds in the wild.
So they're pretty valuable, these peregrines. How much money would they fetch?
So let's talk about the highest priced birds. It's not the peregrine. It's actually called the gerfalcon, which can be a pure, come in many colors, but pure white gerfalcons, which are the biggest falcon, which inhabit the northern climes of the world, Greenland, Iceland, northern Siberia, northern Quebec. There are verified accounts of some of these sheikhs paying up to $275,000 for a single bird. Peregrines are a bit more common and they go for less, but you know, peregrine eggs from the wild, the range can be between, say, $10,000 to $30,000 or $40,000 per egg.
Hmm.
So, you know, you go, yeah. And Lendrum was caught with 14 eggs. I mean, the protagonist, Jeffrey Lendrum, who was arrested at the airport, he had 14 eggs on him. So it was a pretty hefty payday for him had he been able to deliver those eggs successfully.
Yeah, minimum of $140,000 just for those eggs.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
Well, obvious question. Why don't the Arabs just breed their own falcons? Why do they have to resort to this?
yeah, they do breed their own, and there's a huge commerce. There are breeders all over the world. There are breeders in the UK, in the United States, in Germany, South Africa, who do quite a big business with the Arabs, especially in the United Arab Emirates. Well, this is maybe 90% of the commerce. There's another 10% that's done black market, that's done under the table, and it's driven by this desire by some of these avid falconers to get their hands on the wild birds, which, of course, you can't take them. So that adds an allure. It puts an extra value on them, of course, because it's illegal to take them.
Mm. So enter Jeffrey Lindrum, the other hero of your book, I guess, or the anti-hero.
Anti-hero, yes.
Definitely
yes. Let's not call him a hero, please. Please. Yeah. Maybe in some people's eyes.
Yeah, in his own, perhaps.
Definitely not in mine.
So enter Jeffrey Lindrum, and he's got these eggs strapped to his waist, and pretty much it becomes evident that it wasn't for his back issues. He was actually part of a worldwide poaching operation, but it was really a small one. It was basically just him and...
It was
guy.
Basically just him. You know, occasionally he would work with accomplices. He grew up in Rhodesia. One of his accomplices was a Rhodesian war bush pilot who had become really an ace helicopter pilot. And they stayed in touch. And when Lindrum wanted to go up to Canada, northern Canada, to raid the nests of these gerfalcons on cliffs, he summoned his friend, hey, let's have an adventure. And the two of them, along with a third friend of Lindrum's, went on this crazy expedition just south of the Arctic Circle. He worked with a couple times with this helicopter pilot. He also had a specialty. He would work with local sort of ethically challenged raptor birds of prey experts who knew where the Aries were. It's really hard just to go into the wilderness and track down these birds. I've spent some time with McWilliam and the National Wildlife Crime Unit, and you just don't know, how do you find these Aries? Well, you go to somebody who knows the area, who's adept at stealing birds, you make a deal with them, and you work together. So that seems to be the modus mm-hmm. operandi of Lindrum. He wasn't a solo operator, but he definitely sort of ran the show.
Can you describe the misadventure, or I mean, it just sounds like an adventure out of some James Bond movie, of his first trip to northern Canada, where he's looking for this gerfalcon, and he's in this helicopter, and they spot a falcon in the distance flying, and they follow it, I guess, to find its
nest. That's the way they operate. So these gerfalcons have territories. Each one has basically a 5 mile or so area for hunting, for laying the eyrie on a ledge, you know, 1,000 feet above the ground or whatever. So these three guys, they spent, I believe, about 7 or 8 days going up in the helicopter, sweeping along these cliff faces in the most remote corner of the world, looking for nests, Lindrum with his binoculars. And they would spy a nest, and Lindrum would quickly suss out whether they could simply land atop the cliff, and then Lindrum would plant a rope and belay down or rappel down the cliffside with a insulated bag and stuff the eggs into the bag and then climb back up. If that cliff was simply too difficult, sheer face, and didn't allow him to do it that way, then he would tie a rope to the bottom of the helicopter, strap himself to a harness. The helicopter would lift off. Lindrum would be dangling from the bottom of the helicopter. This helicopter pilot, with great precision, would approach the cliffside with Lindrum dangling down below, and Lindrum would reach out and grab the eggs and do pretty much the same thing that he did when he was rappelling, except this time he was hanging off a helicopter. So this went on. I think in this particular expedition that I found out all the details of from the third guy in the helicopter, they stole 28 eggs in the course of a week. So this was a significant heist. And this would have been a large percentage of the hatchlings in that area of Canada that year, all stolen by this wildlife predator.
So he smuggles out all of these eggs and is really flush with his victory and decides to go back again to Canada for more. But then he gets sloppy. He makes mistakes. He's busted, pays a fine.
He's busted.
Not allowed to return to Canada. But he goes around the world doing the same thing, right? He goes to Sri Lanka, South America.
He doesn't seem to be able to quit. There are periods in his life, as I investigated it, where he seemed to have his act together. got married, led what appeared to be sort of a normal suburban life in the Midlands of England. At some point along the way, a large portion of his life sort of collapses beneath him, and sure enough, he is drawn back to the cliffs. And this just continues. You have these patterns of stability followed by pillaging the wild, and he does continue to get sloppier and sloppier and becomes more and more notorious, and it becomes harder for him to operate in these distant corners of the world because he's now known, and there's such a thing as the internet, and he never seems to travel under an assumed name. I mean, he's not the cleverest smuggler in the world, I have to say. He's a pretty impressive physical specimen. But, I mean, it really did descend into a comedy of errors toward the end of his career.
Well, it sounds like an addiction. It sounds like he can't help himself in a way, and that it's not just about the money, but it's about the thrill of the catch and the thrill of the chase, right? The cat and mouse game.
Absolutely.
With authorities.
There's no evidence, as I write in the book, that he ever got rich doing this, unless he managed to sock away a ton of money. But he doesn't seem to have the sophistication to have set up, say, an account somewhere in the Cayman Islands or Panama or whatever. He just seemed to be bankrolled by the sheikhs to go off on these adventures, earning enough to embark on a trip to Patagonia, get his expenses paid for, climb around, going after these birds, which he in a twisted way loved, and bringing them, delivering to the sheikhs, and then doing it again and again and again. It was clearly an obsession, clearly an addiction. And, you know, as far as eggs go, he's not the only one. He's one of the few we know about who has this sort of global business doing it, who seemed to be able to support himself professionally doing it. But, Great Britain in particular is filled with these obsessive egg collectors who steal eggs, have the same sort of crazy adventures that Lendrum did, but just do it for themselves, just so that they can keep these eggs stashed in private collections to stare at them and ogle them and obsess about them. It's really a remarkable phenomenon.
Well, you two met, actually. You met Geoffrey Lendrum.
Yeah.
What's his personality like?
I had talked to him a little bit on the phone beforehand, and I had also spent a great deal of time with one of those guys in the helicopter in Canada that I mentioned, who had a 10-year period where he knew him pretty much better than anybody else. And he told me, if you meet Lendrum, just be aware, he'll charm you. He is a brilliant, compulsive liar. And by that point, I knew a lot of things about him that I don't think he was aware how deeply I had gone into his life. And he just bald-facedly lied to me, one lie after another. It was really remarkable. And just tell me stories that were completely untrue, that I knew were untrue, that I had proof were untrue. And yet he continued. And it was a remarkable performance that didn't fool me for a minute.
Well, the book is filled with truth, so that's good to know. No lies, hopefully.
Everything you always wanted to know about a peregrine falcon smuggler. Yeah.
The book is called The Falcon Thief, A True Tale of Adventure, Treachery, and the Hunt for the Perfect Bird by Joshua Hammer. Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
And Steve Chiotakis joins me now for a preview of Greater LA coming up at 1 o'clock. Hi.
Our novel today will feature the big debate about sex education in California.
Ah.
And pizza.
How's that? Do they go together?
No, they don't. We're going to talk about, obviously, when it comes to sex education in public schools, how much is too much education, right?
Because it all varies, right?
It varies, and there's a curriculum.
What school you
there's
go
an
to.
Official curriculum, obviously, and some parents aren't very happy with some of the official curricula that are out there in California. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about LA's best pizza places. New York and Chicago get pizza, monikers all the time, but what about Los Angeles?
Dasano.
Really? That's your place?
That's my,
all right,
that's my vote.
We'll put it on the abacus. One for Dasano.
Okay.
That's coming up 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Steve Chiotakis. Coming up, artist Pei White is here to talk about her new sculptures at the Beverly Center and why she's inspired by the tile walls at LAX. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Beverly Center is known for its marshmallow-esque exterior, but the interior recently received a facelift in the form of two giant installations by LA artist Pei White. White is a contemporary artist known for her large-scale installations, transforming entire rooms with crumpled foil, tapestry, yards of brightly colored thread. She designed the fabric on the bus seats here in L.A. in rainbow geometric shapes and letters. She even did a handbag collaboration with Dior. Her work is included in the collections of LACMA, The Hammer, MoMA in New York, and the Tate Modern in London. Her two separate Beverly Center installations run alongside the escalators, and they're five stories tall. One of the pieces is made up of thousands of twisty pieces of neon. They're varying shades of pastel meant to evoke sunshine.
So essentially, my goal was to create a giant seasonal affective disorder lamp for Los Angeles. So like a hyper sun for a city that doesn't really need it, but just sort of speculating on that.
She calls this piece Day for Night for Day, a playful reference to the old movie industry technique of placing filters over the lights to create the effect of nighttime when they shot during the day. On the other side of the Beverly Center, she's created another five-story tall installation called Moon Sets for a Sunrise. That's a pattern of ceramic crescents, this time in cool nighttime colors.
This piece is really attempting to talk about moonlight and different types of moonlight. So this idea of multiple moonlights. So we have a harvest moon that transitions into a blue moon, which transitions into a strawberry moon, and then goes into a snow moon.
Each of the moons made up of four tiles and multiple colors. None of the moons repeats a pattern.
So we did a lot of color tests, chose 100 colors, and then threw in three metallics. We have a platinum, a copper, and a gold. And we mapped everything out with the computer program where we were able to not get any repeats.
After riding the escalators with Pei White, we retreated to a quieter area of the Beverly Center to talk a little bit more about her art and her career.
So you grew up here in L.A.?
Yes.
And did you go to the Beverly Center as a kid? Like go to the mall and shop and...
Occasionally, you know, it's a big deal. I grew up in Pasadena, so, you know, it's kind of a trek, like an adventure.
So coming back here to work on the mall, on the reimagining of the mall, the reinvention of the mall, because when you and I were kids coming here, teenagers, it was brand new.
Yeah.
And then it got kind of moth-eaten, and now it's been renovated, and you're part of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, to see something that... you know, you know so well, and as you say, it kind of fell to the side, and then to see this kind of new illumination, and as you turn a corner, it's like, well, that's really different. And there's a lightness, there's this gesture that's, I think, important, this kind of belief, I think, in the city, a belief in brick and mortar.
In 2016, the Beverly Center began a $500 million renovation. During that, the mall hosted other temporary artists in residence, including photographer Catherine Opie. Pei White's public installation could be a more permanent part of the mall.
You don't necessarily know it's there, but you know when it's gone. Mm-hmm. And that these things become part of your molecules if you're in the city and maybe you're in this place long enough. My hope is that it just becomes part of your background, that it's maybe a backdrop to your life or this hour, this 10 minutes of your life. This is just something that's there.
Kind of like the tile work at LAX. Everyone who's traveled in and out of that airport has probably walked through the tunnels with the multicolored tiles on the walls, some in rainbow colors. Pei White thinks of those tiles often in her work.
I think it's a really interesting way to move through space. That color can move you through space, and next thing you know, you're at the end. And all the while, you've had this kind of nice experience is... You know, anyone who's been going through LAX from, like, I don't know, the 60s? Is that when it was installed? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really part of your, you know, travel makes a big impression as a kid or a young adult. And then you have this backdrop to that experience. It sinks in.
That's Pei White, LA artist, and you can see her new installations at the Beverly Center. Joining me now is Michelle Aloy with some listener feedback. Hello.
Hi. So I asked about the Bernie bro culture. Overblown, or does Sanders need to do more to distance himself from it? Emmy says they're the main reason she's not voting for Sanders. It's concerning the way he appeals to so many toxic males. Stacey Mosley says it's legit. and quite Trumpian. But Evan says people are getting fired up because there's a candidate offering policies with substantive change that could save or significantly better their lives. Civility politicking is a tool of the ruling class. David Dixon says, let's be clear, we're talking about a minority of supporters. And he says, as a Sanders supporter, he cringes a little bit at some of it, but says that he's satisfied with Sanders' comments. And Kat Ripley says it's completely overblown, that she's been to a handful of Bernie events, and they're truly inspiring. And while she sees people post online, never Bloomberg, most of the people she talks to says they'll vote for an eventual nominee. So broad spectrum of opinions on the Bernie bro culture, for sure.
Okay. And done civilly.
Without
vitriol.
We did it.
Good to hear that. All right. Thank you, Michelle Aloy. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.